Welcome to the Sourdough Speak, the University of Alaska Broadcasting Services, in cooperation with Alaska Communication Arts, brings you this series of discussions about the history and development of the Great Valleys of Interior Alaska, the Yukon, and the Tanana, and the city of Fairbanks, which developed with the coming of miners during the great gold stampedes at the turn of the century. In this series, the Sourdough Speak, pioneer Alaskans tell you their stories about their lives as they saw and played a part in the unfolding story of Alaskan growth. Now here is your host for this series, Neville Jacobs.
Alaska is a strong land and demanding, and it requires strength in its people, in its women as well as in its men. Human strength emerges from qualities other than the purely physical. There is strength in being able to laugh at trouble or hardship, and strength in being able to ignore or put up with some of the day-to-day difficulties that accompanied life, especially in the early-day Northland. Today, we'll inquire into some of the tribulations that beset early-day Alaskans and learn more about the woman's viewpoint. Among today's guests are Clara Rust, who was interviewed in the last broadcast. Clara arrived in Fairbanks from Seattle in 1908. Then we'll talk briefly with a remarkable woman of Eskimo origin, who moved from her Bering Sea home to Fairbanks, Grandma Tucker. Then with Miss Helen Callahan, whose heritage belongs to the Yukon, where Russian and Indians met in the 19th century. And finally with Mrs. Adolph Stock, who came to Alaska from Germany and found the young town of Fairbanks a contrast to the industrial city of Munich. Each of these guests will help to broaden the picture of early-day interior Alaska and reflect the composite population of Fairbanks, especially from the woman's viewpoint. We started with the subject of disasters in Fairbanks and asked Clara Rust if the flood of 1967 were worse than other major floods. The first was in 1905, followed by others in 29, 37, and 48.
Oh, much worse, much worse, oh yes, because it covered everything. We have pictures, or I did, and I have maybe some somewhere, of early day floods, and the lower ends of town, and our house upon 8th, I remember in 29, in 29, yes, 29, we had the big flood, and we could launch a boat off of our, and we were supposed to be high, and we could launch a boat off of our front porch. But Edelkai town was not flooded.
In between floods, there were a few fires. The first fire was in 1906, the year following the first flood. Clara wasn't in Fairbanks during that fire, but knew about it. The 1906 fire destroyed the entire business district between Cushman and Lacey Streets along 1st and 2nd Avenues.
We had very few fires below Cushman until the first fire we had was from the old tiny hotel burned down. We had very few fires on the lower side of Cushman. Most all of them were up on the upper side. The first fire in Fairbanks started up there between 1st and 2nd Avenue in the building there where a dentist had his office, and the curtain blew into his room, he said, little alcohol flame, and the curtain blew into that, and that's what started the big fire in 1906. And he had his dental office there, and that took all out that middle part of town there.
The Northern Commercial Company had large boilers which kept the pumps going in case of fire. Clara's husband Jeff worked at the NC Company power plant, and during this period, another of the major fires that could have wiped out Fairbanks was controlled by an extraordinary decision to provide an unusual fuel when the ordinary fuel supply was inadequate.
When Jeff worked there, all the employees of the NC Company were on the fire department. They were, I might have a clipping somewhere, I don't know about the NC fire department. And all these boys, they were issued a slip of where their positions were whenever there was a fire. And so when the fire whistle would blow, why, they were all to run to the fire. And the head ones, like my husband in a power plant or any of those, their phones would ring. The operator at the telephone office had a job when there's a fire, because she would have to do that. The first thing she would do was when the fire callers came to her direct, right, she would call the first thing she'd do before she even called the fire department was call the manager of the NC company to get the boilers and things going. Then the fire department, they would call, and then they would, of course, have emergency. And after it was nearly days. And so they, when the phone would ring, and just about the time the phone was ringing, the whistle was blowing, and he was halfway down there, you see. And I could see all the blaze and everything, and where I came into the story, I was watching it, and out our window, we lived right down 8th, and I could see the whole town afire, you know. And I got so worried that I thought, well, I should go down and see if I could maybe have coffee for him, because it was in midwinter and so cold, you know. So I had two good cups that we used for camping, and I filled those with coffee and in a basket on my arm, and I trudged down there. I couldn't do it now, but I went down with this for them, and it's glad I did, because some of them were half standing around half frozen and thawing out, you know, and the coffee tastes pretty good. And then the restaurants started in selling. The restaurants were wonderful then, and the stores like Penske store and even in the NC store, where they would dole out gloves for the firemen to wear to keep dry hands, and everybody was just wonderful. They all worked together. That's one big team, you know, helped all the kids.
Yes, everybody survived because of the
standard. Yes, that's right, because they all just helped. And then, you see, when Mr. Preston would come in, and the steam was low, and Jeff said, "Mr. Preston, I just can't keep up the steam." He said, it's green wood, and they just happened to have some green wood and birch wood, you know. And he said, what in the world are we going to do? He said, "Well, it needs some oil, and he's got something to throw in there." And he says, "Well, how about bacon?" He said, "We have a big supply of bacon," and so they brought in the bacon, and they were just done. He said, "When you think of the price we had to pay, well, of course, we're in high to what it is now, but when you think of how we scrounged, we couldn't hardly afford bacon at our house, because we were living from hand to mouth, and raising the youngsters." And he said, "Just made me sick to see that bacon going in there, but it sure did. It saved the town. It built up the steam, I realized." Mm-hmm.
Today, the man brought in the bacon.
Yeah, right.
He didn't quite bring it home.
No, he didn't bring it home, but it helped to save the town. It wasn't his, of course, then. But, you know, in the early days here, there was no way to get supplies here during the winter time, because there was no train, and everything had to be brought in the boat in the summer. So the bacon was all encased in a heavy waxy stuff. It was hard to really to cut off the bacon, or it was just wrapped in paper. And then when you take the paper off, there's a big coating of mildew, all over it. And so you'd have to soak the bacon and scrape it, and we used to soak ours in soda water and scrape all this
mold.
It's mildew. What is it?
Mold.
It's mold. They scrape the mold off of the bacon, and towards spring, you know, they're going to get pretty bad. And same with the eggs, they would have to bring the whole winter supply of eggs up then, practically, you see, and keep them in a cold place, not freezing, but just at the above freezing. And they had a man sitting there in the back room of the NC store, and he sat there with a box with a hole in it, and what they call candle eggs. He had a candle in his hole or a lamp, and he'd hold an egg up there, and there was a toddy placing egg that went in one box, so you could buy the good eggs, you know, so much a dozen, and then you'd buy the spotted eggs, and then there were cracked eggs, you'd buy cracked eggs. I used to buy cracked eggs for cake sometimes. They almost had a chicken in them, but but anyway, that's where he did the eggs. And then the onions and potatoes, they had a man that went through, they keep rolling the sacks of potatoes so that they wouldn't get sprouts, and then towards spring, they would go through all the sacks of potatoes and break the sprouts off, and same with onions, cut the onion sprouts off. Oh, it was a job to keep supplies those early days. People don't realize, you know, that was a job. And when you stop to think of the good food we had, it's really wonderful. Of course, as I say, when my kids first got fresh eggs, they didn't like them because no taste to them. They were so used to the eggs that always have a little taste to them. Oh, they didn't like the fresh eggs. And when I was diagnosed, one time we wanted to raise chickens, and I saw the chickens because of the eggs, because my kids said they didn't like the fresh eggs.
They just didn't
have any flavor. They didn't have any flavor, no. But of course, you could buy, I used a lot of dried eggs. I used to make scrambled eggs with dried eggs, use them for cakes and things. I used a lot of dried eggs. And you could get dried onions or dried mixed vegetables, and you eat a lot of the dried stuff too.
Now, how about berries? Did you preserve berries?
Oh, yes. We pick berries for the gallon. Go out and get the blueberries, and first would be the raspberries, the ripening and blueberries, and get the Lobos cranberries. And
you mentioned Harbor's cranberries one other time. You said this was your favorite jam?
Jam. I used to make jam. I used to hang it in the bag and mix the jelly, you know, and oh, make beautiful jelly, just like crab apple jelly. You get them before they're too ripe, not pink and pretty smell, you know. You get them when they just turn pink, and then you dry it someday, and then you boil them, and you take a cup of syrup and a cup of sugar, and it just gels perfect. It's just wonderful. And I never squeeze the bag, but I let it drip, you know, and then when it was through, I put through a colander and get all the pulp out, and then I would season it to taste, just be just like apple butter. And oh, we prefer it to almost anything. It's my favorite of all the fruits.
Clara used the wild berries like most pioneer women, but relied on chickens for her eggs. Another lady we interviewed didn't have such a problem with chicken eggs. Grandma Tucker was born on the Bering Sea, and she said she was in her teens before she saw a white man. She explained the Eskimos used the eggs of seabirds that nest on cliffs along the coast. Later, after Grandma Tucker married Mr. Tucker, she worked in a roadhouse cooking. When we interviewed her, she was being visited by another Eskimo lady who joined in the conversation. Grandma Tucker tells how she gathered eggs in her skirt along the cliffs above the sea.
Who wrote nothing? Climb down. Get the eggs.
How did you do that?
Up the eggs. She's done sleep and grubby.
You climbed down the cliff and
you took the skirt off sometime in the cliff. You took the skirt off, climb up, make a fill it up eggs. You took some eggs.
Yes.
And they fall down sometime.
Oh!
Did you drop the eggs?
No.
You pick them up, put them in a... You took the skirt off. You got no more bag. I guess that's
up
for eggs. That's the creek.
Murray's
and the cliff.
Yes.
Ah, good. Two boys, two girls, and Murray's, and two pirates each down here.
Yes.
We get them. Easy. Two pirates, eastern buttons. What made that chicken eat? Easy meat icing. I use for cooking.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Really for chill, and I chicken runs faster. And that way you can stir well, you know, meat icing.
Is that? Yeah. To make icing?
Mm-hmm. And some sweet icing pie in the pot. She cooked it in the roof house too.
Well, for the paper. You did.
You see good?
Where did you do that, Grandma Kathy?
50.
At 50?
Mm-hmm. I make lots of bread. You sell them bread too?
Yes, there are many tricks to living in the North Country, and learning to make icing from seagull eggs and ducks can come in handy when you live away from stores. Alaskans are ingenious people. Another Alaskan who might be called a daughter of the land as well as a pioneer is Miss Helen Callahan. Helen was born sometime in the 1880s, she'll tell you where and how, and was interviewed at her apartment in the Fairbanks Pioneer Home.
I was born way out in the woods, the doctor always says. Where were you born? We were born in the city, and I say no. My mother got tired, Carolyn, so she told them to put pitch a tent. And then they got me in this tent, and I was born out in the woods. And just down below a little summit, she had to climb. But she didn't want to tell me all the way up there. The next day, they hitched up three dogs, and she put a muckluck on, you know, one of those mucklucks. She took me up and over the summit because she had to get back to Canada before the ice melt in the Yukon. We had to get back to Canada, you know. We were way up in the kayak. They were hunting moose for the summertime. They had to dry it, preserve it. So the way they can keep me for summer because they just cut it up, you know, and put strips. And then they put the smoke. The smoke comes up, the flavors. You can have dried meat all summer long, just like they do the fish. Of course, you know, my mother and my father both half Russian. My father was a Russian too. And they were all courses, they were just like New Country, you know, where the white guy comes, they always have a lot of children around. Just during the time the Russians were in, you know. And my grandfather had a store down at St. Michael. And he wasn't my grandfather, he was my mother's first husband. You heard of the big massacre, haven't you? You know, when the Indians killed the Russians, my grandmother's first husband, they thought that my grandmother killed him. So they took her over to, they have a courthouse over there. They used to have a courthouse over there. Not Valdez or something like that. And they found out she didn't kill her husband. There's some of the other Indians around there that killed him. So of course they left her saying she was coming sick. Then she had a make her way back up to her own village, that's the new ladder. And she got back there. Then my mother, my grandmother, married another one. And his name was Ivan Pavlov. And there's a lot of us around today.
Miss Callahan made her home for many years at Circle City and also taught English at Fort Yukon. She was a girl at Circle City when the 1897 Klondike Rush took place and her parents joined the stampede. At that time, Helen was placed in a mission school at 40 Mile. The school was operated by the Anglican Church and the teacher spoke the King's English. Here is Helen again to tell about this period in her life when she stopped speaking the Russian used by her parents on the Lower Yukon and learned the language of the mission at 40 Mile.
Have you ever been over to the... It was right close to the mines, you see, like Miller House and Deadwood and all those places. I was about 6 years old. They had the first schoolhouse, the government school. Well, we thought it was the most beautiful place because we never was in a real school. You see, the missionaries came and they taught us in their homes. And this was a real long building. Oh, that was wonderful. Then Dawson was stuck. They had all left and went to Dawson. See, all the white people went to Dawson. And there was no more schooling since. So they put us, my sister and I, my mother put us in a mission up at 40 miles. 40 miles away from Dawson. Minnie made it over here. Her father was a French. And they left her to there in the year with the other, another mission, not mission, but the minister and his wife. So, of course, that's how we learned to talk.
The proper English,
yeah. Sure, because you know, all these people that talk English, they came from London, didn't they? And this woman, she was a teacher from London at Cleveland, that came with Bishop Thomas. You see, the Russians, they were all from down the river. And all their... Oh, who they talked was, my mother couldn't talk English, they talked Russian. All of them talked Russian. I understood Russian when I was a little girl, you know, because that's all they talked. So we learned to talk, they talked English. I know I did.
As accustomed as a person becomes to living in the wilderness, there are always certain surprises. Here is Miss Callahan again.
I won a car. When I came back from teaching school over in Fort Yukon, I had to learn how to drive it right away. So, every summer, we used to go out for picnics, and we would go over the circle, you know, that's 160 miles. And there used to be wild animals all over. We never had any of them chase us, but once we left the circle, and one of the men said, now you be careful of that wolf. It's an old wolf about 6 miles from here. So when we were coming up, Mama forgot about this wolf. And of course our little dog, he's always had one of those little dogs, you know. And he was standing at the window looking out. And he saw this dog, he thought. And he was going to get out of that window, and I told Mama, roll it up quick. And I remembered it was a wolf there, you know. And he was following, you know, he was running with the car. I don't know whether he was after us or not. But I told Mama, I said, just shut the car. And she was hanging on to her little dog, Brian, little fox terrier. And she was saying, Flash!
Flash!
She thought it was a dog. He running in all fast. I guess he was just excited about the dog being safe inside, you know.
And it really was a wolf.
It was a wolf, an old wolf, but he looked like a dog. You know, one of these huskies.
In contrast to Miss Callahan, whose lineage in Alaska is very long, is Mrs. Adolph Stock, a relative newcomer from Germany. Yet Mary Stock is also representative of the cosmopolitan population of Fairbanks. Mary tells her story.
It was raised in Munich.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, how did you happen to come to Alaska?
Well, my husband had already been here over 9 years. He came over in 22. He had a sister in Fairbanks, and they were mining here. Oh. He went back to Munich for a visit in 1930. And we got acquainted with each other and engaged. And in December of 31, I came to this country and right up to Fairbanks, right up to Alaska. I came from a big city. Munich then already was an ultra-modern city, really, you know, with over 1 million people. And then coming to Fairbanks was quite a change already.
Well, what was it like when you came here in 1931?
Well, in 31, I would say Fairbanks was a pretty small town. I think we had about 5,000 people. And
how about any roads? Did you have, was the highway in then to the...
No. Well, there was a trail. There was a trail. There was a wagon road light, you know.
How did you personally get here?
Oh, I came across the Atlantic and through the States and up the inside passage from Stewart by train. It took 28 days from Munich.
Well, then, really, at that time, the railroad was the major
transportation. That's right, between the coast. And the train only went once a week, and we only got mail once a week. And if you were from Europe, you got mail usually, it took a month to reach it, you know. It was a cold day in December on the 3rd when I arrived here. My husband went down to Stewart and got me down there, and we got married. The little Catholic church on the 5th. But I might as well say, when we came up with the train, when we came to the depot, I was so surprised. There must have been about, at that time, or like many parts of Alaska, have always been known for more men than women, you know.
Yeah.
But when the train pulled in at the depot, I think there were about 100 men over there. Just standing there, see, Adolph was then at the Nordale, and he was very well known. And of course, there was a little piece in the paper that Adolph Fried is to arrive from Germany. And I think everybody that read that little item went to the depot, and there was about 100 men standing over there. And I didn't realize that they all came to see what Adolph Fried looked like. It was cute, it really was, you know. And of course, everybody spoke, and I couldn't understand or speak a word, you know, but. Some things like that you want to never forget.
Well, tell me about your wedding.
As I said, we got married in the Catholic Church. I might recall to you a little incident that I will never forget. There was my husband and I, of course, and our two witnesses, and the priest was Father Eline. He was up here for years and years. And I noticed that he asked my husband for something. I couldn't tell if it was a paper or what it was, because I could not understand one word, of course. And my husband looked very perplexed and grasped me by the hand, and we ran out by the church again. And as we ran out, I said, "Are we married?" And of course, he did not have time to explain this to me. But now, of course, I know that the priest asked for the license. And my husband said, "Well, you know, I forgot to get the license." And it was on a Saturday noon when the commissioner's office closed at 12 o'clock. And it was exactly 5 minutes to 12 when we backed over to the church house. And we did get the license. And back to church we went again and finally got married. So
That was a close call.
It really was. And speaking of the wedding, of course, at that time, Fairbanks didn't have a flower shop or a florist like we have now, you know. We are very fortunate now. But there wasn't one flower to be gotten in Fairbanks. And to me, this was a little sad because, you know, every girl dreams of a nice wedding. But we had a nice dinner, though, at the Model Cafe that time. And there was a German baker there.
Oh.
And he seemed to just realize what was missing. He baked us a lovely a wedding cake with a bunch of red roses on top.
Oh, how pretty.
So I said, well, that takes the place.
By coincidence, the German baker who made the roses on Mrs. Stock's wedding cake will be a guest in a later interview. But to continue with Mary Stock, we asked her how life in the North compared to her homeland.
To begin with, everybody says, what do you want to go to Alaska for, you know? And, well, it was all different, of course. Over there, we had all the modern conveniences already. And, well, when I got here, we had the wooden coal stove from the... we had to buy every drop of water. A bucket of water was too big, and so you bought a bucket or two every day. And of course, I had a lot of new bed clothes and all new towels and all these things. And I thought, how am I ever going to wash with two buckets of water? But then it started melting snow, and by one catches on to do almost anything and get by with, you know. There was a fellow that sold the water. He had a well down on 9th and 10th. He was Fred, the waterman, we called him Fred. And he came every day with the horses, and we bought the water by the bucket.
How does it sound? With a strange sound here.
I'll say that was a strange sound. Anyone that ever lived in a log cabin knows that as the temperature changes, you have these odd sounds, cracking of the logs, and of course being a good deal alone in the house, and not being able to speak to anyone, therefore I was alone a lot. Whenever a sound was that, oh, I thought, oh my God, I hope it isn't a bear or somebody's breaking in, I wonder what, you know. But you get used to everything.
And how about that? Did you have any experience?
No, never. In fact, in all these years, I think I only saw two bears on our outing.
People who live in Fairbanks find it a remarkable place. Today it is a contrast of modern homes and city buildings with a log cabin snuggling close by, and where many people still prefer old eggs because fresh ones have no kick. And although few people have encountered bears close to town, it is still possible to wake up and find a moose grazing outside your bedroom window. Women are still challenged to be ingenious in homemaking because of frequent lack of special items that might be found in a large city, but they find this challenge stimulating rather than a hardship, and perhaps it is this outlook that most readily binds the women of the North together. In today's broadcast, we have had the opportunity to share the life of four women who make their homes in Fairbanks and through many years have contributed much to the building of the Northland. In our next broadcast, we'll return to the man's world and life in the wilderness of early Alaska. This is Neville Jacobs inviting you to be with us for the next interview with the Pioneer Alaskan.
You have been listening to The Sourdough Speak, a series of discussions about the history and development of interior Alaska in taped interviews with pioneer Alaskans. The Sourdough Speak was produced by Alaska Communication Arts in conjunction with the University of Alaska Broadcasting Services.